with a something like an Icon, you're flying the whole time, which is great. I noticed that I always land an airliner better if I've been flying the Icon recently. And I wish the airline industry would realize that and would encourage pilots to do more small airplane flying, because I think it would make them more proficient and better pilots overall.
Hi, I'm Paul. In this episode, I'm speaking with Jason Depew about how flight training schools are preparing pilots to join the airlines, as well as the best methods for anybody with an interest in aviation to become a private pilot.
The first thing I tell people is you don't need some fancy, shiny new airplane with these fancy digital avionics and these big glass screens to learn to fly or to even enjoy flying.
Now, Jason is a retired Air Force pilot who has flown special operation missions overseas, trained pilots in a number of different military aircraft as an instructor, and is also a 737 captain currently for a major airline. Yeah, but Jason currently writes a column for Flying Magazine that focuses on something a little bit different, finance. Jason isn't just focused on having people fly safely, but allowing them to be able to afford to fly at all.
I don't think everybody should be a flight instructor. I think there are some people that may lack the patience or the communication skills or some other things to where they wouldn't be the great flight instructor. And I've encountered some of them throughout my career, and it's kind of disappointing to see. There are other opportunities for those people.
So if you've been looking for motivation to get back into flying, or have just always kind of wondered when is the best time for you to start, hopefully this episode offers some information and some guidance as to what being a pilot is really all about.
It's really cool to realize that you're able to act in this world and do something amazing, and that it's all under your own control. And especially it's humbling when you're flying passengers to realize that without you, they'd be in trouble. They might not survive the landing if you weren't there. And it's a big responsibility. And so it's a thing that should be humbling and that we should appreciate the opportunity to have, but it's also very empowering. And I think a person who can do that, who can achieve that in their life, I think they'll realize they can achieve a lot more as well.
This is Adventure Flying. It seems like you've flown so many different type of aircraft, you know, everything from the airline to, you know, seaplane with Icon and so on and so forth. I guess I'll put the task on you. How would you like to introduce yourself, your pilot experience, to our audience?
Sure. I do have some hours. I've got almost 8,000 hours, but I enjoy breadth in flying. So I learned to fly in a Piper Cherokee in Colorado in high school. I went to the Air Force Academy and flew gliders there. I've got more than 900 glider flights, mostly teaching. Then I went to fly in the Air Force. I flew the B-1, the bomber with the wings that sweep back and forth, and it's supersonic and it's amazing. I flew the Pilatus PC-12 as a spy plane for special operations. I taught pilot training in the T-6, and I flew a Bombardier Global Express as the E-11. It's just a big radio relay that flies over Afghanistan. So I got a pretty varied Air Force career. And then I moved on to the airlines, and I'm on my fourth airplane at the airlines now. I'm flying the 737. And it's a lot of fun. It's nice to be able to go to some different destinations and see some new things. And thankfully, I've been very blessed with the financial side of things, that I'm not scraping to put food on the table, and airline pilot pay is very generous. So I've got this time to do other kinds of flying. So yeah, I get to teach in the Icon A5, which is just fantastic. It's a fun airplane. I owned a Cessna 170 for many years, so I love tailwheel flying and kind of backcountry grass strip airport flying. And I do as much teaching as I can. One of my specialties is, especially friends in the squadron who buy an experimental aircraft. Well, they need some hours for insurance to get checked out on it, but there's no CFIs who know how to fly it. So I have a very deliberate process of, well, let's look up your aircraft. Let's look up the manuals. Let's look up the NTSB accident database. Let's look up any news articles about it and figure out together how to safely fly your airplane and then go safely fly it. So I've gotten to fly a lot of different airplanes before. I really enjoy it.
Why finance? So you have this column with Flying Magazine, and just in general, a lot of the stuff I've researched with you. What's your credibility, I guess you'd say, in being able to speak to the financial aspect of either becoming a pilot or how to finance your flight training? And why do you decide to write about that opposed to everything else you could write about?
Sure. Yeah. I don't have a degree in anything. I'm not, you know, certified in anything. So anything I say about finances is just one guy's opinion. But I am a math guy and a computer guy, and I've done a lot of you know, personal research, reading a lot of books, and just building a lot of spreadsheets and running a lot of math. And so my wife and I both work hard, and we save really aggressively. And we've been able to save up enough money that basically, if we both lost our jobs forever, I lost my pilot medical and she lost her ability to practice dentistry, we'd be fine. We'd be able to put food on the family's table and live in a house and cover our needs forever. And honestly, once you start researching that kind of stuff, you realize it's shockingly simple, the math behind that. And I won't say it's easy or quick to achieve that point, but it is very possible for any person, at least in a wealthy country like the United States, to achieve that state. And so I really want to help people get there. And that's kind of why I start writing about it.
It's kind of a catch-22, right? So what we'll get into here, what I'd like to get into, is flying is incredible.
Yeah.
The adventure of just becoming a pilot. And how do you help people get into that? Or how would you suggest people start pursuing their PPL in a way that's financially sound?
The first thing I tell people is
prevent them or prohibit them from pursuing the adventure of flying.
Do you
have a way of introducing people to flying in a way that can be affordable or some immediate tips or guidance?
Lots and lots of really great airplanes that are really fun to fly. They might not be as fancy on the instrument side, but you don't need all of that for basic flight instruction, for basic training. So I really encourage people to find an older airplane in really good condition and learn to fly that. I also encourage people to think about the sport pilot rating. You know, if money's going to be a tight issue for you, start with that. You know, at 20 hours and probably just a little bit, you could be a licensed pilot. You can take your friends and family flying. You can enjoy aviation and start building your flight experience. And that's essentially half the cost of a private pilot's license. Another one that I'm a big advocate of is glider flying. You know, once the training for it is relatively, it's close to the same cost as flying, but once you get your license, you know, you pay maybe $50 for a tow to get towed up into the air. A lot of glider clubs don't even charge to rent the glider, and if they do, it's pretty cheap. And then from that point on, your ability to enjoy that aviation and the amount of flying you get to do is based entirely on your skill and your ability to read the environment around you and fly within that environment. And so if you're good at it, you can fly for hours, you know, for just the cost of that $50 tow. And you can really get a lot of bang for your buck there. So I'm a big advocate of soaring.
Yeah, so I think what you're speaking to, and my personal experience too, right? The reason it fluctuates between, you know, might be 10, might be 15, might be 20, is a lot of it is it's proficiency-based. And I think people sort of know that, but they don't really understand what that means. Do you have suggestions? So glider is actually a really interesting point, I think, because that I think it's stick and rudder and being familiar with your environment, and I'm sure it's almost always VFR flying, right? Which is what which is what a PPL pilot will do. But do you have any other suggestions on how to? Obviously, you don't want someone to rush through private pilot training, but if someone is able to get through it in 40 or 50 hours versus 70, 80, or 90, that can have the cost. I had a pilot instructor tell me once that, you know, opposed to just always being obsessed with getting time in the cockpit, one of the best things you can do is just read.
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent hundreds and hundreds of hours teaching people to fly. I've done it as a civilian. I've done it in the military. And I can tell you with a certainty that if you want your flight training to be cheaper, you have to do it consistently, you know, on a regular basis. And like you said, don't rush through it, but you need to stay on it. That's, you know, a bare minimum flying, you know, once a week, maybe as a civilian, ideally more than once a week, if you really want to keep current and not have to relearn things as time goes on. Part of that is saving up some money in advance. So you don't, you know, get to a point in your flight training where you're out of money and you're forced to stop. If you have to, you know, delay the start of your training a little bit to save up enough money, that's really important. Another thing I really advocate is chair flying, kind of like you talked about with reading, right? You want to read through and have all your knowledge and everything prepared when you show up for your lesson. Because if your flight instructor is spending time going over the book knowledge with you, he or she won't be able to cover as much with flying. But chair flying is the same way. When you chair fly, you're essentially going through all the same maneuvers and events you're doing in the air. And you can do them as many times as you want, and it's basically free. So the more time you spend doing that, the better you'll do. And I have absolutely seen that with every student I've ever taught. I know from the first moments of the flight if they've been chair flying or not.
Can you give it like an example for the chair flying? You know, you're sitting in your chair, you're looking over the sectional charts, you're pretending to be on the radio. I mean, it can manifest itself in a lot of different ways, but what's What's an immediate example usually?
Yeah, well, it's for every part of your training, chair flying is doable. And for me, it's, you know, sitting in your kitchen or your bedroom in a chair, or, you know, maybe, you know, your bedroom with the door closed so people don't laugh at you because you're going to look a little bit funny. But you sit there and in your mind, you really picture yourself on the flight deck of your aircraft. And if it's checklist, you get the checklist and set it on your knee and you run through every checklist. And if it's, you know, the takeoff procedure or the traffic pattern procedure, you really think through every step. I'm entering the traffic pattern of 45 to downwind. I'm going to look over my left shoulder. I'm going to make sure there's nobody there. I'm going to turn on downwind. I'm going to run this landing check. I'm going to fly this airspeed. I'm going to have this power setting. Okay, it's time for my base turn. I'm going to check over my left shoulder. Looks good. I'm going to start my turn and just really step by step all the way through it. The more you do that, the better you'll do in flight training. Guaranteed.
Do you see any, are there always trends or there's is it the maneuvers where people usually get held up and they have to spend an extra 5 or 10 hours or a specific maneuver, or is it the radios? Based on your flight training experience, where's one area where people can really hone in on and make sure that they are practicing as much as possible, maybe even before they get into spending money on flight training, you know, just to make sure it's something they have the competency for before they even jump in?
Sure. I think each student is different. Each one has a trouble in a different area, but for all of them, it seems like the point where they have the hardest time is the point where they've put in the least preparation before they show up. So whatever the next thing you're doing is, whether it's learning the entry parameters for a maneuver, or whether it's learning how to read a sectional chart, or whether it's learning how to communicate at a towered airport, you really need to put in the time to prepare for that before you show up for your lesson. You know, for ATC communications, you can go to liveatc.net and listen to real-time air traffic control. For any kind of like cross-country flight planning, you can, you know, read about it. You can actually do a practice flight plan and bring it to your instructor and say, how does this look? For procedures, you know, checklists and systems knowledge, you can just read through the manuals and practice that over and over on your own. And just anytime you're doing something, if you show up to the lesson prepared, your training will always be better, more efficient, more valuable for you.
So what factors in your estimation determine if a school is going to be right for a certain pilot? I mean, you have the pilot looking to get their PPL, who might have a full-time job and something else, as compared to someone looking to join the airlines as quickly as they can.
For me, one of the most important factors is your flight school has to be close to your house. If you have to drive an hour to get there, it's going to be a huge pain for you to get to each lesson, and it'll make you less likely to have that consistent, regular training schedule. So kind of you have to take what you can get or be willing to move to where you're going. So if you're on the professional pilot track, I think a young person has to be willing to move and go live by that training course if necessary. When it comes to those training courses, talking about finances, you know, there are all levels of flight school that can provide more accelerated or consistent flight training, right? You could go to a big name, an Embry-Riddle or UND or Auburn, somewhere like that, and do a collegiate course or a full-time course or ATP flight school, like you mentioned. And those are great programs. They're really expensive. They're outrageously expensive. You know, if you can afford to do that, if you can find scholarships and other ways to make that affordable, go for it. I would always encourage people to look around and look at other options. There are kind of state school type operations or smaller, maybe Part 141 flight schools that are really good options that don't cost nearly as much as those big name schools. So I would always look out for those. So when I tell people, if you're trying to minimize the cost of flight training, you know, consider a mom and pop school somewhere near you. I always recommend you go with a place that has at least two of the type of aircraft you're flying, because invariably, you know, one of them's going to go down for maintenance and you don't want to be forced to sit while it's grounded. But as long as the school has a good reputation, and you definitely want to ask around, and the maintenance practices look good and they've got at least two of the airplane you're flying, I think you'll probably save money going that way.
You've flown seemingly everything in so many different envelopes, right? Like, to stay on the flight training path though, right? What can you say what part is usually the most enjoyable about becoming a pilot? Really any aspect, either a seaplane pilot or an instrument or just the PPL.
Sure. Professional aviation in most cases is about going places. And sometimes it's taking people or taking cargo or just going somewhere. I remember when I was in Air Force pilot training, I flew the T-6 as a student. It's a really awesome turboprop, you know, pressurized tandem seating, fully aerobatic aircraft. And we did lots of aerobatics and it was very fun. And then you go on to the instrument phase of training and you learn instrument flying. And at first it's incredibly boring. They have these really great simulators, but the simulator room is dark and it's cold and you're doing these incredibly boring maneuvers for hours and hours and you just can't stand it. But you're learning important basic principles. And then you go out and you actually do it in the airplane. And it's really difficult at first because you have to apply those maneuvers while you're actually talking on real world radios, and that can get very busy. And then you get to go on your first cross-country flight. And I will never forget my first cross-country flight. I'd been flying quite a bit. I'd done a lot of glider flying and, you know, some civilian flying, but I'd never done any serious instrument flying. And we took off and we flew from Del Rio, Texas to Houston. And we climbed up into the clouds. We were in the clouds for the entire 2-hour flight. And then we flew an instrument approach into Ellington Field in Houston. And I remember we're flying along and all of a sudden we break out of the weather and the airport is right in front of me, exactly where it should be. And I hadn't seen the ground for the last 2 hours. And it was just so gratifying and impressive and amazing to me that you can safely and effectively navigate across the country in the weather by using instruments. And all of a sudden you're somewhere new, interesting, and you've escaped kind of the podunk town of Del Rio and you're in the big city, Houston now. And the world is yours. It was a really cool, fun experience.
I think you have your Icon A5 authorized flight instructor, but you, which gives you some seaplane experience, shows you have some seaplane time. Since I've been at Icon, I feel like I've discovered how relatively few pilots have some seaplane time or have even landed on the water in some capacity. Can you speak to what the seaplane pilot experience has given you as a pilot and why you'd recommend it to other people, assuming you would recommend it?
Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful. Highly recommended. For me, the Icon, when we teach new Icon pilots, new owners, we talk about becoming an Icon pilot and how that kind of opens up adventure opportunities for you. This is the Adventure Flying Podcast, right? And it really gives you an ability to go places that very few people will ever go, especially in an airplane. I remember with one owner, I got to go to Georgia and fly with him for a few weeks. His name's Arthur. And we had a lot of fun flying, but he lives near a lake and that was kind of the only water in his area. And he said, I want to go somewhere else. I want to go to the coast. I want to fly in some salt water. I want to try beaching and ramping and all these things. And so I was like, okay. And so we went on Google Earth and we picked out a spot that had a good boat ramp and some beaches and some protected water. And we looked up in the Seaplane Pilots app to make sure we could fly there. And we looked up on the sectionals to figure out what the airspace was. And then we went and did it. And we went out to San Simon Island and Jekyll Island in Georgia. And we flew all over the place and had this great day. And we ate delicious barbecue. And we landed in these canals and waterways back in behind the barrier islands. We drove Icon up the boat ramp. And it was hilarious. There were all these kayakers getting ready to launch from the boat ramp. And this airplane drives up the ramp and stops. And they were just in awe. And it was so cool to be able to go explore this new place. And then we were back home that night, back in the hangar, because it's got such a far reach. You can travel so quickly. It was really cool.
Do you feel like, so you fly the 737 for a living, and then you fly the Icon A5 also for a living in some capacity. But do you feel like as you're flying both planes, just describe both airplanes almost by definition couldn't be any more different.
Right.
Do you as a pilot feel any different as you're flying those? Is there a different type of, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for exactly here, but how do you approach flying each? Is there really a difference between the two? Are you in a different mindset?
No, it's very much a different mindset. There's always, you have checklists and procedures that you do in each one. And for me, good procedures save lives for pilots. So I always follow that. But with the 737, you're going somewhere far away. You're going to be on autopilot for a lot of the time. Honestly, most of it is autopilot work and radio work and just monitoring systems. That's completely different than the A5 where you're flying the whole time. And instead of looking at the systems, you're looking out the window and you just kind of enjoying the world around you. So it is very different. It's more hands-on. It's more fun, I think, flying the Icon. I enjoy the 737. It's engaging and the life is fun. The job is fun. But I always look forward to going back to flying the A5. And something that's interesting with the with any airliner, most pilots spend an average of less than 15 minutes hand flying the airplane on any given flight, which, you know, for one thing, that's not fun or exciting, but it also can have an impact on your proficiency, especially if you do that for years on end. Something like an Icon, you're flying the whole time, which is great. I noticed that I always land an airliner better if I've been flying the Icon recently. And I wish the airline industry would realize that and would encourage pilots to do more small airplane flying, because I think it would make them more proficient and better pilots overall.
Where do you think the future of the airline industry is in regards to seaplanes? I mean, you see some starting to pop up in New England. Some pilots, young pilots, start out there doing the Cape Air thing or doing the float because it's an easy way to build time and it's kind of a niche. Do you think seaplanes are going to start having a bigger role in the future as, you know, we figure out some electrical propulsions and realize it's you know, a water takeoff in some ways is easier because it already gets you into different airspaces and gets you into different ports and so on and so forth. Do you have an opinion there or any type of insight?
I think there's some potential for it. Yeah, probably on the smaller end of the scale. But right now there's a company doing flights from Boston to New York. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I hate New York's airports. I have to fly into all three of them, New York, JFK, and LaGuardia. And they're all just terrible. It's a miserable experience for a pilot and a passenger. And the passengers flying on this float plane, they go directly from Boston to the East River in New York City. And they just get off the plane and they're right where they need to be in Manhattan. What a wonderful way to travel, right? I can see a lot of places where there's a lot of applications for that. So you've got some definitely some potential for more of that as electric airplanes come online. There's the Dornier Sea Star is a really cool airplane. It's a twin boat hull seaplane. That would be a really great airline kind of application, I think. So yeah, I think there's more potential for it.
So circling back to the becoming a pilot, becoming a young pilot working their way to ATP, you know, what is your forecast on the industry right now? From the financial side, as you mentioned, it can cost 60, 70, 80 grand to get your ATP, maybe a little bit more, yeah. And you're just, you know, maybe deciding between college or this school. We hear all the time about now there's the pilot shortage again and airlines are scrambling for pilots. What is your quick analysis of the industry of basically becoming an airline pilot as a career for people who usually ask you?
Right now, especially for the next 5 or 10 years, but even going forward, the demand is insatiable. During COVID last year, the airlines let several thousand of their most senior pilots retire early to kind of cut the dead weight. When they didn't have a lot of cash to pay everybody. And so they lost thousands of pilots, and they still have thousands of pilots retiring over the next few years for age 65. The demand for new airline pilots, it will suck up everything in the regional airlines, everything in the military, and still not have enough. So there is absolutely an opportunity for a great career if you want to be an airline pilot.
Is there an opportunity for someone maybe looking for a career change at 30, 35, 40? Or is that just going to be too much of a grind? You're going to be, you know, a CFI making 18K a year or whatever it is. What route do you think? Do you think it's going to open up more routes for people that are just beyond the young pilot? Is that kind of what you're thinking too?
There is absolutely time, even if you're in your 40s or maybe even 50s, to go through, get your ATP, get your 1500 hours, and get hired by an airline. The older you get, the more your opportunities might be a little bit limited. Maybe you'll fly at a regional airline instead of one of the majors, or maybe you'll fly at one of the ultra low cost carriers like Frontier, Spirit, you know, those kind of places instead of going to an American, United, Delta. But those are still great careers. Those are still a lot of fun. There's also the cargo airlines like Atlas and ATI that are, you know, flying Amazon contracts. You could be flying a 767 or a 747 around the world. That'd be really cool. So there are lots of great opportunities out there, even if you're a later in life joining profession.
Yeah, I guess no matter what time you do jump in to become an airline pilot, one of the, you know, the rites of passage, if you will, is becoming a flight instructor, right? To build your time and to get paid to build your time. I mean, you are obviously a very experienced flight instructor. I don't feel like we really get a perspective or as much of a perspective on the flight instructor. It's usually about how do you get your private's license, yeah, and how do you go through? What kind of guidance do you offer or can you offer someone who wants to become an airline pilot, loves flying, and now all of a sudden has to become an instructor,
sure.
Right? I mean, how do you feel like the industry is preparing people and what guidance do you have there for anybody that's just becoming an instructor?
Sure. I think we need to do a better job of preparing people to be flight instructors, of talking about what it is and encouraging it. I don't think everybody should be a flight instructor. I think there are some people that may lack the patience or the communication skills or some other things to where they wouldn't be the great flight instructor. And I've encountered some of them throughout my career, and it's kind of disappointing to see. There are other opportunities for those people. They could, you know, tow gliders or banners. They could do ag work. They could do freight hauling. They could do pipeline patrol. There are other options for the people who really don't want to do that. If you are considering it, though, it can be a lot of fun. You really do have to approach it as, you know, you're a professional teacher at that point. You need to pay attention to your students. You need to understand who they are and where they're coming from. When you go for your CFI, your flight instructor rating, you have to take two written exams. One is the aeronautical knowledge test. The other is the fundamentals of instruction. And a lot of people tend to try to rush through that fundamentals of instruction portion and just kind of min run it and do, you know, do the least possible. Those principles are really important. And if you want to be a great instructor, you kind of need to pay attention to those things and try to make that your craft for a few years and focus on that. Do the best you can to really be a good instructor.
Are there parts of your job now that you owe to that instructor portion of your career? Like, what did being an instructor give you now as a captain for a 737, other than just more time?
Oh, yeah. Being an instructor teaches you to pay attention to what's going on and figure out not just what's happening, but the root causes of what's happening. So if, you know, the air traffic control radios are busy flying into Chicago and we need to, you know, get cleared for an approach and, you know, stuff's going on, you can really take a step back and really understand what the other pilots and what the other air traffic controllers are thinking. And it enables you to more effectively operate in that environment. It also just helps you have lower stress while you're flying. You know, as in a flight instructor, you'll never be busier than that. I remember there was one night I was flying the PC-12, so a spy plane in Afghanistan supporting special operations troops on the ground in Afghanistan. And there's a stack of aircraft, you know, fighters and attack aircraft that I'm in charge of controlling. And there's good guys on the ground that were talking on the radios. And I've got sensor pods looking at all different places in the target area. And I'm trying to manage all of this. And that's busy enough, but sometimes they would have me as an instructor sit in the right seat of the airplane, run one of the sensors, and have the unqualified aircraft commander sitting in the left seat doing most of that coordination job. And it was intense, right? It really forces you to be on your game, to know what's going on, to pay attention. And after that, anything else I ever do will be easy in aviation. So it really prepares you for the worst. It's really good.
That's one adventure that you remember. Do you remember another adventure, like that one moment where it did remind you why you wanted to become an aviation, why you probably went through some of the grunt work and how it paid off?
Yeah, I could tell stories all day. One is flying a two ship of T-38s low level through Big Bend National Park. It's in Southwest Texas. And it's desert, but there's lots of good mountains out there. So we're in this loose fluid formation and we're flying at 500 feet above the ground at 360 knots ground speed. So fast and you're diving through these canyons and valleys to try to, you know, stay below radar coverage, practicing that as you fly in formation and just going, rolling to 120 degrees of bank as you carve across ridge lines and following the lead aircraft and just seeing lead out in front of you up against the backdrop of these mountains. And we swoop down by the Rio Grande in this valley area. And then all of a sudden I look in front of us and there's just this wall of granite in front of us. It's probably 2,000 or 3,000 feet above our level. And then I just see lead, plug the afterburners, pitch the nose up and just blast over those mountains. And I follow lead right over and crank inverted almost to go across them. It was just amazing. There's nothing like it in this world. I just love it.
Do you, so someone going out to become a pilot's probably not going to have that experience, right? And I right. think people go into becoming a pilot to get something similar to that. I mean, that might be, you know, someone just flying solo, that could be that same experience to them. It's all about perspective, yep. right? Do you have an experience or something you usually hear from people? There's usually the moment in life that was before when they became a pilot and after they became a pilot. It is that kind of milestone. Can you kind of sum up yeah. for you or from what you hear from other people, what that becoming a pilot, what it gives them, what it usually offers them?
Yeah, I think, you know, our society teaches people to try to be a little bit humble, maybe self-effacing. You know, don't be a jerk. Don't stick yourself out there too much. Be a little bit timid almost sometimes. Don't offend anybody. And when you learn to be a pilot, you finally get it. And you get to go be in command of your own aircraft, whether it's flying solo or taking passengers or whatever with you. That's a powerful experience. And it's really cool to realize that you're able to act in this world and do something amazing, and that it's all under your own control. And especially it's humbling when you're flying passengers to realize that without you, they'd be in trouble. They might not survive the landing if you weren't there. And it's a big responsibility. And so it's a thing that should be humbling and that we should appreciate the opportunity to have, but it's also very empowering. And I think a person who can do that, who can achieve that in their life, I think they'll realize they can achieve a lot more as well.
Mm. I guess the final one I'll leave you with, what is the biggest difference with the A5? You kind of touched on, you can go pretty much anywhere, quote unquote, yeah, with the A5, but even just from more of a pilot perspective and less a discovery, what would you say about the aircraft that is different, either from an engineering or mechanical, or I guess I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah, it's easy. The design of the A5 is fantastic. It was designed, it's the brainchild of Kirk Hawkins, right? He was an F-16 pilot. The F-16 is probably one of the most capable fighter jets ever made. It's a jet that relies on angle of attack, AOA, for everything. And you can tell that he demanded excellence and that he demanded that the A5 really be capable and really be an AOA driven aircraft. So the A5, from the minute you get into it, the way the ergonomics of the cockpit are laid out to the way it handles both in the air and on the water, you can tell that some really fantastic engineers and some really fantastic minds thought out exactly how it should work and were able to design it to do that. And so whether, on the water, it handles beautifully on the water. It can be very easy to get the basics. It's very easy. You can spend your whole life mastering the A5 on the water, but the basics are simple. And the air is the same way. It's got so much maneuverability, so much capability. The fact that I can be fully stalled, the stick all the way back in my lap and the stick shaker screaming, and I still have 30 degrees of roll authority and 10 degrees of pitch authority. And all I need to do to get out of the stall is add a little power and relax the stick. It's so much better than any other aircraft I've ever flown. I almost can't even describe it. Just a fantastic design.
And when you say better, I guess to put it in this context, right? If anything, if the A5 is the only thing that someone's ever flown, and then they go hop into a C-172 and either try to learn that or just to try to fly it because they have to, I mean, what are one or two of the biggest things that they're going to either miss or need to learn, or I guess the differences between those two?
Yeah, well, the first thing you're going to miss is the angle of attack gauge, because that is the single most important advancement in aircraft instrumentation in years. I could take or leave, an iPad with fancy electronic flight bag or, this gorgeous giant Garmin glass cockpit. Who cares about that stuff? That AOA gauge is magic. Your stall speed in an airplane or your desired approach speed or anything, it all varies depending on the aircraft weight. You have to correct it for wind gusts. You have to correct it for bank angle. And for students, sometimes it takes them a long time to figure out that, stall speed versus bank angle is this big consideration. The AOA gauge in the A5, it takes all that into account. It's always right. If you're in the green, you're always good. If you're in the pattern, you're flying on angle, white line, you are always good. And it's so simple and straightforward. And then with flying approaches, so many pilots get into trouble because they get too slow, whether it's in a turn or even flying straight, just because they get distracted. And part of the problem, I think, is a normal airspeed indicator is this, it's an analog instrument, but it's a digital printout, right? You've got to fly a certain airspeed, 65 knots, 75 knots, whatever. And you're constantly checking back and your brain is having to do extra calculations to not only look at the instrument, but to see what your airspeed is and then decide, is that the proper airspeed for my phase of flight? And those extra brain bites are a waste that an Icon pilot doesn't have to deal with, because you just have that AOA gauge. It's mounted top center, so it's almost always in your field of view anyway. And it's very simple to see if you're in a good, safe place flying or if you're not, you need to make a correction. It's just so fast and simple.
Is there anything, I first off, thanks very much for your time, for giving us your insights and just kind of let me talk shop. Is there anything you'd like to add here that I might have left out here just to hand you the mic?
I'll just say that, you know, aviation is a wonderful thing. It's a privilege that we have in our country. And it's something we need to protect, make sure we're always, you know, being good stewards of what we have, whether it's on the water or in the air, and go out and enjoy it. You know, find a way to make it affordable for yourself, but go out and enjoy it and take people with you. And some people are worried about not having enough pilots in our country. I think the easiest sell, the best way for us to get more pilots is just find friends and family and neighbor kids or whoever and take them flying and show them how great aviation is. Because once you do it, you're going to be hooked.
Yeah, so thanks again to Jason Depew. If you guys like to follow along, check out his High Finances column or articles that he writes up on flyingmag.com. And yeah, again, if you're interested in learning more about this podcast, it's presented by or hosted by Icon Aircraft, who makes the Icon A5, which Jason and I were discussing throughout this program, the amphibious aircraft. So if you'd like to learn more, you can go to iconaircraft.com. Until the next episode, again, thanks for listening, everybody. My name is Paul, and we'll catch you on the next one. Take care. Thanks.